Good day. Today is Wednesday, 8th October 2025, and as is now becoming my new tradition, let me remind you, if you've watched this video and liked it, or watched part of this video and liked it, to please remember to tick the like button. Now with that, let's move to the substantive matters that we're going to discuss, and today they are going to be focused very heavily on the situation in Ukraine, or rather the conflict in Ukraine, because over the last 24 hours we have had some very important statements being made in Moscow. The first of these statements has been made by the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov. Ryabkov is somebody who many people believe will eventually succeed Sergei Lavrov as Russia's foreign minister. Well, that remains to be seen. But in the meantime, he appears to be the most important Russian foreign ministry official, other than Lavrov himself, dealing with relations with the West. And Ryabkov has made an address to the Russian parliament, to the State Duma, in which he has said that the momentum that appeared to have been created by the Anchorage summit has been spent, that there is no sign that negotiations to settle the conflict in Ukraine are ended, and that in effect diplomacy between the United States and Russia on the question of ending the conflict in Ukraine has come to a stop. These were his words, as reported by the Russian news agency TASS. Unfortunately, the powerful momentum from the Anchorage summit in favour of peace agreements has largely been undermined through efforts by opponents and efforts by supporters of war till the last Ukrainian, mostly among the Europeans. The result of these destructive actions is that progress has stalled. Anyway, there we are. That is the Russian view. There was the summit meeting in Alaska. Trump and Putin appeared to have come to some kind of understanding of each other's positions, even if, as I have pointed out many times, there is no real sign that Putin was willing to concede on any of the substantive matters that the Russians have repeatedly brought up since the start of the conflict. And other than the one concession that the United States made, the President Trump made to Putin, his agreement that diplomacy should move towards a full negotiated resolution of the conflict, as opposed to a ceasefire followed by negotiations, it's clear that Donald Trump came with no fresh ideas and no plan how to move the process forward, other than to suggest a tripartite meeting, a trilateral meeting between himself, Zelensky and Putin, which of course, in the circumstances, the Russians were not prepared to agree to. So we all remember what happened directly after the Anchorage meeting. The Europeans came together in all kinds of agonized and angry ways. Zelensky participated in their discussions. They badgered Donald Trump on the question of security guarantees for Ukraine. They came away with the belief that Donald Trump had made commitments to provide Ukraine with security guarantees. Donald Trump appears to have led the Europeans to think that the Russians had agreed to the kind of security guarantees that the Europeans were demanding. And I pointed out in many programs at the time of the Alaska summit and subsequently, and we also discussed this on the Duran, that this was not the case at all, and that the security guarantees that the Russians envisaged were of the same type as had been discussed by the Ukrainians and the Russians in the abortive negotiations that took place in early 2022, shortly after the special military operation began, and which led to a draft agreement initialed by both sides in Istanbul in April 2022, which envisaged security guarantees being provided to Ukraine by the five permanent members of the Security Council and potentially other states, including, of course, China and Russia, security guarantees, which incidentally would have given the Russians veto rights over the deployment of foreign forces on Ukrainian territory. So that was all that the Russians have ever agreed to. I don't know whether Trump misunderstood what the Russians were saying, what Putin told him at the Anchorage summit, but that was crystal clear to me at the time, and the Russians clarified it afterwards. So the Europeans came away from their discussions with Trump thinking that Moscow was showing more flexibility and was becoming more open to the idea of Western-style security guarantees to Ukraine, NATO-light security guarantees to Ukraine, which is, of course, never the case. And supposedly, Trump also gave the Europeans reasons to think that the Russians would not object to the deployment of European peacekeeping forces in Ukraine, something which there was no reason to think that the Russians had agreed to do, given that they had always publicly, strongly spoken out against it. And, of course, after the Anchorage meeting and after all of those debates and discussions, the Russians again rammed the point through again that they have never agreed, but on the contrary, strongly oppose deployments of Western peacekeepers in Ukraine, in any part of Ukraine, in any form or in any way. So, a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of confusion around the time of the Istanbul summit. I believe that the Russians also came away with misunderstandings of what Trump had talked about. I think the Russians, and I'm basing this on certain interviews that the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov gave, I think the Russians came away with the idea that Trump and the Americans were willing to discuss the wider general security architecture in Europe. I never thought that was the case, and well, it's turned out that it wasn't. So a meeting took place in Anchorage. Putin and Trump came to that meeting. The meeting was very poorly prepared in great haste. There were stories that the Russians had agreed to a freeze of the conflict in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, a ceasefire in the fighting in those regions, provided the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass. Again, I pointed out in many places that there is no evidence that the Russians agreed to that or even proposed it. And it would be illogical for the Russians to agree to something like that when they had already got Donald Trump to rule out a ceasefire, that the two things were completely inconsistent with each other. Anyway, it's clear that there was misunderstandings of the positions taken by each side, and that this led to a summit meeting in Anchorage which must, I think, now be seen as a lost opportunity. Now, Ryabkov and the Russians are blaming the Europeans rather than Donald Trump himself. And, well, this is consistent with Putin's current policy, which is to continue to hold out the door, to keep the door open for future diplomatic engagement with Donald Trump himself. I've discussed in previous programs, and we've recently discussed, Alex and I, on the Duran, that this position appears to be coming increasingly under criticism in Russia, that there is a growing view within Russia, including within the Russian political leadership, that Trump is simply not a reliable and effective partner in negotiations between Russia and the United States and between Russia and the West. And I have to agree, if we go back to Anchorage, if we look at what has happened since, well, the Europeans acted as they always do. They do not want to see a settlement of the Ukraine conflict on any terms that are fall short of an outright defeat of Russia. They made this clear many, many times. Their proposals at best involve a temporary freeze of the conflict on the existing lines, but they continue to insist that Ukraine is on an irreversible course towards NATO, something which, of course, the Russians treat as a complete red line. The Europeans continue to insist that Ukraine is on an irreversible course towards the EU. They continue to say that the Russians have and must have no veto over these processes, which is absurd, given that this is the attitude which has catapulted us into precisely the conflict in Ukraine, which is playing out now. But for all that, it remains the European position. The Russians have spoken about the need to demilitarize Ukraine. The Europeans continue to insist that Ukraine must be fully remilitarized with the most modern weapons. And the Europeans continue to insist that whilst the Russians may remain in temporary occupation of territory in eastern Ukraine, eventually, through some means or other, at some point in the future, all of this territory, including Crimea itself, must be returned to Ukraine. The Europeans say more things. They talk about reparation payments by Russia to Ukraine, European statements, joint statements, continue to say as much. There will continue to be demands within Europe for war crimes trials of Russian officials, with the implication being that these must in time extend to Vladimir Putin himself. All of this has indeed been happening since the Anchorage summit meeting. But it was never going to be otherwise. The Europeans took exactly that same approach before the Anchorage meeting. They've taken that approach ever since the start of the special military operation, 3.5 years, well, more than 3.5, almost 4 years ago. They have consistently stuck to it throughout that time, and they show no sign at all that they are prepared to waver from it. Vladimir Putin, over the course of the brief press conference that took place in Anchorage after his summit meeting with Trump, said that he hoped that the Europeans would not act to try to sabotage the understandings that the Americans and the Russians had supposedly reached in Anchorage. I said at the time that this was a completely false hope. It was an absolute certainty that the Europeans would do precisely that. though the Russians continue to go through the motions of saying that it's the Europeans, it's some hardliners in Washington who are responsible for the failure of the negotiations. And Ryabkov is talking now about the failure of the negotiations. It's impossible to read his words in any other way. I have to say this. I think that though they maintain the fiction that it is the Europeans who are at fault, though they maintain the fiction that others, hardliners in Washington, might be at fault, in private, in conversations with each other, they must be blaming Donald Trump. They must be telling Putin specifically that you are wasting your time with Donald Trump, that Donald Trump is never going to come through. He doesn't really understand the conflict. He shows no real interest in understanding the conflict. What he wants is a ceasefire, an end of the fighting, even if it is only temporary, an end of the fighting for the remaining 3 years that he is president, so that he can focus on other things and perhaps get himself awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. That he is not someone who will, in the end, come through. And I have to say that I agree. The fundamental problem with the Anchorage meeting, and I said so at the time, and we discussed it at the time on the Duran, is that it was arranged in far too much of a hurry. Donald Trump found himself in an awkward position because he had appeared to go along with Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal's demands for bone-crushing sanctions against Russia. Those sanctions were not really sanctions against Russia at all. They were, in fact, tariffs against countries, primarily India and China, that bought Russian energy products. Donald Trump didn't want to do that, even though he appeared to be pushed very strongly in that direction and had missed the opportunity to push back decisively against it. So Trump, in order to get out of that hole that he'd dug himself into, giving ultimatums to the Russians that he would impose sanctions and tariffs like that on India and China unless the Russians agreed to a ceasefire within 100 days. Trump, in order to get out of that hole, sent Witkoff to Moscow. Witkoff had a meeting with Moscow. Putin doubtless explained the Russian position to him again in painstaking detail. I am sure that Witkoff, in turn, explained it all once more to Donald Trump. But Witkoff's instructions from Trump were to get a summit meeting set up between Trump and Putin. And probably Trump didn't pay much attention to what Witkoff was saying. And probably Trump didn't understand much of it anyway, because I don't think he is interested in the details of the conflict. So the meeting took place without proper preparation. And the Russians have been warning about this for months. What I think the Russians expected after Trump became president was that the Russians and the Americans would each appoint proper negotiating teams, perhaps headed respectively by Rubio and Lavrov, that those negotiating teams would have a number of sessions, that a proper agenda for the summit would be worked out weeks and months in advance, that each president would be properly and fully briefed about the position of the other. And nothing like that happened. after Witkoff secured Putin's agreement for a summit meeting between Putin and Trump, the respective foreign ministries had only a couple of days to sort things out, and that was nowhere near enough time, so that the two sides came together in Anchorage with nothing agreed and no real understanding fully of each other's positions. And this is why we are where we are today. But it goes beyond this, because Trump himself, having secured that meeting in Anchorage, again, having got himself out of the mess he found himself in with the threats of tariffs on China and India, he no longer had to move forward with that. Well, after that, Trump did what he always does. He sought to appease his critics in the West. He agreed to meet with the Europeans and Zelensky in the White House. He had no need to do that, but he did. He discussed with them security guarantees and troop deployments in Ukraine, failing completely or disregarding completely that the Russians had not been properly consulted about the one and had repeatedly rejected the other. He talked about a trilateral meeting between Zelensky and Putin and himself, or a bilateral meeting between Zelensky and Putin, even though that was not discussed substantively in Anchorage either. He carried out a theatrical stunt during the meeting in the White House, when he left the meeting and telephoned Putin in order to try to get Putin, obviously, to agree to a meeting between himself and Zelensky. And Putin, of course, said a polite no and said, why are we even talking about this? Why don't we move forward instead with what I have been suggesting already, which is an upgrading of the delegations, the diplomatic delegations in Istanbul, and discussions through the three working groups between ourselves and Ukraine, something which I suspect has never really registered with Trump. So all of that led to further confusion and disappointment, with Trump veering since then to making more threats, confused threats about supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, and suggesting at some times that he was going to continue to arm Ukraine, and at other times that Ukraine would be armed with American weapons bought for by Europeans, and that kind of thing. Now, I have to say that Donald Trump likes to project himself as this very strong, very confident leader, able to make decisions, able to enforce these decisions on the Washington bureaucracy, able to keep the European allies in line, able to intimidate and pressure American adversaries. But in dealing with this crisis, he has not shown strength, he's shown weakness. He's also failed to understand, and I said this on many occasions, the painstaking way in which negotiations of this kind between the United States and Russia need to be conducted, and how they have been conducted in the past when actual agreements are reached. Look at the way in which, for example, he has responded or failed to respond to Putin's recent proposal for an extension of the START Treaty. Now, that treaty is due to expire in February, and as I've discussed in many programs now, once it expires, there are no further arms control agreements between the superpowers left in existence. No limitations on either side possessing strategic weapons. This is a very serious issue. It was recognized as a very serious issue during the Cold War and at a time of extreme tensions between Russia and the West, at a time when certain Western leaders are talking about Europe in particular being in a kind of state of war with Russia. One would have thought that discussions, serious discussions about strategic weapons and nuclear weapons between the American and Russian superpowers was more necessary than at any time. I would add that it does seem that the Russians now are moving forward with deployment of a whole new set of strategic weapons, of which the United States has no real counter. The Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile is apparently now in serial production. The Russians are supposed to have tested, or being about to test, I'm not sure which it is, the new Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missile. There are many people who speculate that this is a fictional weapon or that the program is troubled. I suspect that the program is troubled, but programs for innovative weapons of this kind are often troubled. It doesn't mean that they are not going to succeed eventually. And, well, there continue to be many rumours about the nuclear-powered Poseidon submarine drone. My own understanding is that it is already in serial production and in service, though so far there is only one Russian submarine, the Belgorod, that is in a position to deploy it. Anyway, we have all of these very destabilizing, or potentially very destabilizing and extremely dangerous weapons coming into production. We have the Oreshnik system coming into production and being deployed by the Russians in quantity in Western Russia as well. It is not a nuclear weapons system, but it has, according to Putin himself, the potential, if used in clusters, to affect as much damage as a nuclear weapon would. And, well, it is now being put into production, and to me at least, in that respect, it looks potentially destabilizing. So all of this is happening at the present time on the Russian side. One would have thought that the United States would be concerned about it. The United States speaks of its concerns about the continued nuclear build-up by China, which is indeed great. Surely, given that China and Russia are both partners, and given that they're both adversarial nuclear superpowers, the United States needs to be in discussion preferably with both, or at least one of these adversarial superpowers, if it is to maintain not just strategic nuclear parity, but some assurance of its own overall security position. So, the obvious thing for the president to have done in this case would have been to have a discussion with Putin, or to send his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, to meet with Lavrov, or to have contacts between the US military and the Russian military, and preferably to have done all of these things, and to have agreed to this 1 year extension of the New START treaty that Putin was offering. And of course, Putin made it clear that 1 year, that extra year, needed to be used to get negotiations on limiting and perhaps even reducing strategic weapons, to get negotiations like that started. And again, a responsible president surely at this particular time would have wanted to do that, would have set up, established a negotiating team. There are any number of people in the Pentagon, in the United States, who would, if brought together, form, constitute a very strong negotiating team. Anyway, set up a strong negotiating team to take that forward with the Russians. Instead, all that we got was a flippant statement from the president when asked by a journalist what he thought of Putin's proposal, that it sounded like a good idea. No action at all. And note that the president made that comment even as he's letting speculation run wild that the United States might be about to supply Tomahawk missiles, cruise missiles to Ukraine. Missiles which have an intercontinental range and which were designed originally as strategic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads and which would have been used as part of the United States' nuclear arsenal against first the Soviet Union and then Russia. So the president, flippant response to a proposal about limiting strategic weapons or extending the existing treaty on strategic weapons, and giving the impression that he is frankly not particularly averse to supplying the Ukrainians with a long-range strategic weapon which was originally designed to have a nuclear capability and which could be launched from the territory of Ukraine itself. Now, again, I suspect that this issue of the Tomahawk has been brought up by President Trump, or has, well, he hasn't been brought it up. It was suggested by Zelensky, but he's run a lot. He's run with it because President Trump doesn't again want to slam the door. He doesn't want to say no to the Europeans and to Zelensky and to the hardliners in Washington, who he perhaps fears the most. He is terrified, and I think this has been widely said, and I think it is true, that if Ukraine falls, he will be blamed, and he doesn't want to be blamed. And, well, so he goes along with disastrous ideas of this kind, which, as Putin himself is now pointing out, is going to throw Russian-US relations back into the deep freeze. And we see now what Ryabkov is saying, that the momentum or from Anchorage has largely been undermined and that the progress has been spent and relations between the United States and Russia, not just about ending the conflict in Ukraine, but about improving or at least stabilizing their relations, that has been lost as well. Now, I have to say that in some respects, outright hostility, outright declarations of hostility towards Russia, since we used to get from the Biden administration, disastrous and ill-conceived though they were at least had the advantage of being clear and straightforward. What we have had instead from the administration has been chaos and muddle. And in some respects, I suspect that this has made things worse. Because from a Russian point of view, they understood that the Biden administration was entirely and completely hostile. But they probably did say to themselves when Trump became president, well, it does look as if this president might indeed be interested in patching things up in some ways. But they're now saying to themselves that this is not going to happen with this president either. And given that this president won't do it and can't do it, well, let's forget about trying to achieve it at all. I suspect that there are plenty of people in Moscow saying exactly that. I was reading an article that has appeared in a Russian journal profile by a Russian political scientist, Dr. Vasily Kashin, who is the director of the Center for Comprehensive European and International Studies at the High School of Economics, which is one of the top Russian universities dealing with international affairs. It is sometimes compared to the London School of Economics in London. Anyway, it's again uses relatively polite language, but it's difficult to see that it is anything but deeply critical of the way in which Donald Trump does things. Trump, and I'm quoting now, Trump has stripped away layers of bureaucracy, bringing Russia policy directly under his control and that of a few loyal aides. There is little expert machinery around it. The military-to-military channels that should be discussing demobilization or verification measures remain idle. Instead, the Trump administration is trying to present Moscow with a finished product, a ready-made Western consensus hammered out with Western Europe and Kiev, and demand that Russia either accept or face the consequences. Remember Eve Smith's article, which I've discussed many, many times, in which she says that the West spends all its time negotiating with itself, and by the time it gets to talking to the other side, it has completely lost contact with what the other side might be concerned about and might insist upon in negotiations. Well, here you see a Russian essentially saying the same thing and saying that this is exactly what the Russians have been presented with by the Trump administration. And then Kashin goes on, Washington is ratcheting up pressure, verbal barbs like calling Russia a paper tiger, leaks about longer range missiles, renewed attempts to isolate Russian oil exports through India. In every respect, Ukraine is marching in lockstep with the United States, from political messaging to targeting decisions. And he says that Trump's aim is that the United States can afford to step back, that Europe, armed with pooled resources and US-made weapons, can sustain Ukraine indefinitely. It is a neat theory, but delusional in practice. And of course he is right. And trying to address this problem and negotiate with the Russians in this kind of way, as Dr. Kashin's article all but said, in my opinion, all it has done is sown mistrust and deepened doubts in Moscow, and probably at some level at least, caused Vladimir Putin himself, the person who has pursued the dialogue with Trump most actively. Anyway, it has caused Putin some political embarrassment. So anyway, that's where we are. Ryabkov is now saying no negotiations, no discussions with the Americans. Everything has hit a wall. There's no sign that things are going to move forward. And he has said this to the Duma, to the Russian parliament itself. So we must take this as an official, considered view by the Russian government and by the Kremlin itself. I am going to say straight away that I think that the recent chatter in the West about supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine has been the final straw. Putin has already said that if they are deployed or sent to Ukraine, that will bury any prospect of an improvement in US-Russia relations. And we see that the Russians, to all intents and purposes, have now given up on Trump and on the whole idea of an improvement of relations with the United States whilst Trump remains president. So there it is. Now, the Russians have said more things, because yesterday there was a big meeting. We're not exactly told where, whether it took place, except that it happened in St. Petersburg. But anyway, there was a big meeting between Putin and his senior military. And when I say his senior military, I mean Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff. He, of course, was there, as was Andrei Belousov, the Russian defense minister. But the other people who participated were the group of forces commanders conducting military operations in Ukraine. And it was an interesting meeting, and it involved, according to a photo study that the Kremlin has provided, a visit to a church of some kind. It seems to have taken place in at least two formats, because we see Putin sitting with the same group at different positions around a different table, just saying. So this looks like a big meeting. But the interesting thing about it is that, again, the Russians, the Russian Defense Ministry, the Russian General Staff, has done something which it has taken to doing recently, but which it emphatically did not used to do earlier in the war, which is provide us with a detailed official update of the situation on the front lines in the conflict in Ukraine. And this took the form of a summary provided by by Gerasimov to Putin. But then we know that after Gerasimov spoke, each of the individual group of forces commanders, starting with General Nikiforov, who is the group of forces, who is the commander of group of forces north, he replaced General Lapin, who had been the previous commander of group of forces north in August. Lapin apparently had developed health issues and has now retired. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss those sort of things. Anyway, Putin heard the reports from the individual commanders, but it was Gerasimov's summary that the Russians have published. And again, it provides us with an interesting overall picture of the battlefield, the actual state of the battlefield. So Gerasimov says that the Russians are continuing to advance on long nearly all axes. He said that the Ukrainians have concentrated their main forces on stabilizing the situation in critical sectors with the aim of slowing the Russian offensive. He said that the Russians are now in the process of capturing southern Volchansk and are in the process of securing their buffer zones in Sumy region and in Kharkiv region. He said that the Russians have now pushed the Ukrainians out of all of Kupiansk except the southern quarters, and that there is now fighting underway to clear those. This is sort of consistent, by the way, with information that we're getting from the various telegram and reporting channels. They speak of a deepening crisis for the Ukrainians in Kupiansk and of the Ukrainians holding on to a small number of positions, basically on the west bank of the Oskol River. Gerasimov said that Yampol, the big village or small town west of Siversk that is key to Ukraine's ability to keep the grouping, the Ukrainian garrison in Siversk, supplied. Anyway, Gerasimov says that the Russians now control the majority of Yampol, and fighting there continues. He says that he said that the Russians continue to fight their way forward, as he puts it, in the towns of Siversk and Konstantinovka. Gerasimov has and the general staff have repeatedly claimed that there is actual fighting underway inside Siversk and Konstantinovka itself. This has not been confirmed by any other source. Both Russian and Ukrainian reporting channels have basically denied that this is the case. However, Gerasimov continues to say it. And, well, there are some reasons to think that he, and of course one must assume that he is better informed, is right. He said that the entire territory south of Konstantinovka, south of the Kliban Bik Reservoir, is now under Russian control. The destruction of encircled enemy formations south of the Kliban Bik Reservoir was completed yesterday. Then he spoke about the area where the fighting, he says, is most intense, which is the Pokrovsk area. And he has this to say about it. In an attempt to halt our advance, the Ukrainian command has redeployed its most combat-ready units from other sectors, including from strategic reserves, to these directions. Pokrovsk and the area of the village of Novopavlovka, which is located to the southwest, some distance to the southwest of Pokrovsk in the Dnipropetrovsk region. But then Gerasimov has this to say: nevertheless, overcoming enemy resistance, the formations and units of Group of Forces Centre continue their offensive. Our assault detachments are advancing in the southern districts of Pokrovsk. North of Pokrovsk, Rodinska has been encircled and mopping up operations against Ukrainian formations are currently underway. Now, this is information that was previously published by Radovka. Of course, it could be that Radovka are getting their information from sources within the Russian military, within the general staff. But we see that Gerasimov appears to be confirming Russian advances within Pokrovsk, and the Russian encirclement of Rodinske and of the effective steps, the fact that Rodinske itself is likely to fall under Russian control soon. And then he discusses the situation on other battlefronts. He says that a group of forces east continues to advance deeper into enemy defences in Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporozhye region, and that there are, and that, by the way, is an important advance about which he says, interestingly, rather little. And he says that further to the west, group of forces Dnieper is advancing in Primorskoye and Stepnogorsk. These are two communities immediately to the south of the great city of Zaporozhye, which is itself, of course, located on the Dnieper River. And then he said something quite interesting. He said that the Russian General Staff has a plan for targeted strikes on Ukrainian military installations and facilities of Ukraine's military industries, and that these strikes are being carried out according to the General Staff's plan. Priority is given to neutralizing enterprises producing missile systems and long-range unmanned aerial vehicles. So this is an admission that the massive Russian drone and missile offensive that is being conducted against Ukraine is not an improvisation and is not a response to Ukrainian strikes against Russian oil refineries. It is part of a plan worked out by the Russian military's general staff, in other words, by the overall Russian military leadership. It's this actual plan which is being followed. And then Gerasimov finished by saying this: "Comrades, Supreme Commander-in-Chief, the formations and units of the joint force will continue offensive operations in accordance with the approved plan. The joint force commander will provide a more detailed report on the current situation." The joint force commander is, of course, himself. But never mind. What we've just been given is, if you like, an executive summary. He will then go ahead later over the course of the meeting and provide a detailed report, a much more detailed report, for Putin's ears and Belousov's ears and for the other military commanders participating in that, in the meeting, of the state of the battle. This summary was drawn up for publication. It's what the Russians now want us to know. But notice the other thing that Gerasimov said. "The formations and units of the joint force will continue offensive operations in accordance with the approved plan." Now, in my program yesterday, I mentioned how I had read an article, a recent article on his Substack blog by the brilliant Russian war reporter Marat Khairulin. And I pointed out that that article was written on the 20th of March of this year. In other words, it's an old article. But that it described what, on the 20th of March, Khairulin expected would be the Russian offensive thereafter, from that point onwards. And I pointed out that it was almost identical to what had happened. In other words, Khairulin's expectations of what the Russians would do over the course of the summer of 2025, the spring and summer of 2025, have proved almost exactly right. Now, here we see confirmation of the deduction that I made from Khairulin's article, that the Russians must be working to a detailed plan for the war, one drawn up by the general staff. And here we see Gerasimov himself confirming as much. Formations and units of the joint force will continue offensive operations in accordance with the approved plan. There is a plan. The Russians are working to a plan, and they have been following this plan meticulously. Now, I'm going to make a guess here that this plan was probably drawn up in 2023. The Russians, when they first advanced into Ukraine in February 2022, did not at that time, in my opinion, have an overall plan for the military defeat of Ukraine. Instead, they hoped that the advance on Kiev would push the Ukrainians towards a diplomatic compromise. And as Alex and I have discussed many times on the Duran, and as I have discussed in several programs, many programs, that objective came very, very close to being achieved, or so it seemed, with the initialing of the draft agreement in Istanbul in April 2022. And then, of course, everything unraveled. The Western powers committed themselves to a program of military support for Ukraine, intended to achieve a military victory for Ukraine. They urged Ukraine, not that I suspect Ukraine needed much urging, to engage in a succession of offensives. First, the Kharkiv offensive of August 2022, then the Kherson offensive, which it is now clear was meticulously and thoroughly planned by the US, and whose primary objective was the destruction of Russian forces in Kherson region, west of the Dnieper River. That objective was not achieved. Then the Russians obviously had to deal with the Ukrainian offensive, which is really the American-sponsored and commanded Ukrainian offensive of the summer of 2023. And as we know, they responded by creating the Surovikin line, retraining their forces, by conducting a limited mobilization in the autumn. And I think over the course of that time, whilst that offensive was underway, the Russians, the general staff, worked on their plan to win the war. And once the Ukrainian offensive was out of the way in the autumn of 2023, the Russians started to implement that plan, and they have been doing so ever since. In fact, I clearly remember how in the autumn of 2023, the then Russian Defense Minister, General Shoigu, Sergei Shoigu, visited a production factory and let slip the fact that the Russians were working towards a plan which appeared to have expectations of the end of the war, presumably with a victory in 2026. At the time, I wasn't sure whether this was a production plan, a plan for production of military equipment, or whether it was an overall plan for war, for the military victory in the war. I should have realized, since we're dealing with the Russians, that it was both that it was both a military plan and an industrial mobilization and production plan intended to achieve the military part of the plan, the actual offensive, to support the military offensive that was envisaged as part of the plan. This is very much the way the Russians do things. They're very methodical. They plan things extremely carefully and in great detail in advance. And once they've worked it out and planned it through, they stick to it. And that is what we're seeing. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, Khairulin at least expects that the plan will take the form of an advance beyond the Dnieper, eventually to capturing Ukraine's Black Sea coastline, including the towns of Nikolaev and Odessa, and that dovetails closely with a map that we saw on display in Gerasimov's office a few weeks ago, which also showed the outcome of the war, a map of the outcome of the territory controlled by Russia at the conclusion of the war, and that clearly included Odessa and Nikolaev as part of Russia as well. So again, a very interesting set of comments by Gerasimov, and by the way, by Putin as well. Putin also spoke in ahead of Gerasimov's summary, and I noticed one of the most interesting facts about Putin's words, which is that basically he set the scene for Gerasimov to speak, but at no point in his discussions did he mention possible diplomatic negotiations, diplomacy or negotiations or interactions with the Ukrainians or interactions with the Americans. The entire discussion was purely focused on the military side. So that also reinforces my view that Putin himself basically no longer believes that there is going to be a diplomatic end to this conflict, a negotiated end to this conflict. And that brings me back to Ryabkov's words to the Duma, because I don't believe it is a coincidence that the Russians showed us this picture of Putin meeting with the top Russian military commanders, receiving reports from them, getting reports from Gerasimov, at the same time that Ryabkov was addressing the Duma and was telling the Duma that the diplomatic momentum created in Anchorage is spent. I think that the Russians, in their own way, were signalling to themselves as much as everyone else that diplomacy has failed, that the Americans aren't really serious about doing real things that would end the war. They spent all their time, as Kashin said, negotiating with the Europeans and the hardliners and never really take into account our concerns. And therefore, all that is left is for us to continue and to fight and to win the war and to focus on that. So anyway, two very interesting things that have happened in Russia. One in Moscow, one in St. Petersburg. And very ominous for those who would like to see a negotiated and diplomatic end to the war. It is likely, it is possible, at least possible, that that door has now finally closed. Anyway, let's touch on a few other things. Firstly, let's talk about the military situation. Of course, Gerasimov has given us quite a lot of information in this summary, but there's been more information coming from the front lines. It does, in fact, seem as if Russian progress in Pokrovsk is actually ahead of where Gerasimov thinks or says it is, that the Russians now appear to be moving decisively to clearing all of Pokrovsk south of the railway lines. There is apparently one area of high-rise buildings in central Pokrovsk that the Russians still have to capture. But the problem the Ukrainians have, the Ukrainian defenders have there, is that as far as I can see, they are now essentially cut off from supply. So anyway, that's one battle that is continuing. Gerasimov is absolutely right that the net is tightening every day now around both Liman and Siversk. And it's likely, in my opinion, that there is already fighting in Siversk and a collapse might come very soon. I discussed, I think it was in yesterday's programme, that the silence that there has been about the fighting in Kupiansk is interesting and suggests that that events there are heading towards some kind of conclusion. There were, in fact, reports yesterday on various Russian reporting channels that what has basically happened in Kupiansk is that though the Ukrainians are cut off and are unable to get supplies or even perhaps retreat, they are in effect surrounded and fragmented into groups. Some of them continue to put up a tenacious resistance, but it is tough street fighting to clear the few remaining areas of Kupiansk that continue to be under Ukrainian control. And perhaps the most dramatic information of all is that it looks as if the Russians have broken through both Uspenivka and Poltavka in Zaporozhye region. And it looks as if those two villages, big villages, small towns, are likely to be stormed and fully captured by the Russians relatively soon. And, well, once that happens, the Russians can move on, cut the supply roads to Gulyapolye. And I would say, looking at a map, it seems to me that if the starting point of the Russian offensive towards the city of Zaporozhye from the east is the small town of Velikaya Novosilka, which the Russians captured at the beginning of this year, well, the Russians have now traversed something like 40% of the distance. And it could be that with the ground opening up, especially if Gulyapolye falls, then the pace of the advance might even accelerate from this point on. I suspect that, by the way, that one of the reasons why the Russian advance in this area has proved so rapid and why the Ukrainians are finding it impossible to slow the Russians in this area is because the Russians have sorted out their logistics. with the fall of Ugleda, they've been able to unblock and repair all the railway lines. They've already built important railway lines from Russia across their land bridge to Crimea itself. And the result is that there is a constant flow of men, machines and munitions, shells specifically, to the frontline forces, which is probably one of the things that makes the Russian advance, specifically in this area, irresistible. Now, that brings me back, by the way, to the question of logistics, because the fundamental problem that Ukraine faces is that obviously it is suffering from more manpower shortages. There have been some attempts in the Western media now to challenge this. This is provoking anger, from what I can see, amongst Ukrainian commanders and Ukrainian soldiers, who, on the contrary, are furious about the fact that they are their forces are so severely depleted. But of course, the other big problem is that the West has never been able to supply weapons systems to the Ukrainians in anything like the kind of quantities that the Ukrainians need. And there is particular discussion and talk about the situation with artillery shells. And there's been an article, very interesting video, which says that the Europeans and the Americans have failed. One of the major reasons why the Americans have been unable and the Europeans have been unable to increase artillery shell production to the levels that are needed is because there is no supply of TNT, because basically factories producing TNT across the West have closed over the last 30 years. And most importantly, there isn't a reliable supply of high-grade cotton fibre necessary to produce the TNT that goes into those artillery shells. And that part of the reason for this is that most of the high-grade cotton fibre is exported and produced by China. Now, on that, by the way, I should say that my own understanding is that the Russians do have their own reliable supply of high-grade cotton fibre, and it does not come from China. That doesn't mean that the Russians aren't importing some, but that it comes from the former Soviet republics of Central Asia, which continue to be heavily integrated into the Russian economy in all sorts of ways. Now, on this topic of high-grade cotton fibre, I have a sense of déjà vu, because I think it was about a year ago that a very reliable source that I quote often pointed out this very problem to me. This was entirely not news to me, this information on this video. All I would say is that it is interesting that since then, there has apparently been no progress made in resolving this problem. And the reason there is no progress made comes back to the underlying problem in the Western industrial system. Industry in the West, to the extent that it focuses on production, tends to focus mostly on very, very high-end production, where the big profits are being made. So, to give an example, there's an interesting article that recently appeared in the Financial Times, which spoke about how the United States is actually becoming more dependent on China for chips. This is because all the energy, all the investment, or the intellectual thinking in the United States is overwhelmingly focused on producing the extremely sophisticated, very high-end AI chips, which of course represent only a fractional part of the total of chips that are used in industry and in products. The Chinese, by contrast, are busy expanding their production of AI chips. In August, they unveiled a plan to treble it, but they are also busy increasing their production of medium range and low range chips as well, low end chips as well. The article made the point that these are not obsolete chips in any sense. They are, on the contrary, foundational chips. They are the chips that are mostly used in industry and in consumer products. The uses for AI chips, by contrast, are relatively few, at least at the moment. But the point is that it's much more profitable to focus on AI chips. It's much more glamorous. It's much less interesting and much less attractive to build chips at, you know, 28 nm or even bigger, even though for most applications they're much more useful. The profit margins in doing that are much, much smaller. And what is true in chips is going to be true in high-end cotton fibre. It probably isn't ultimately profitable for Western textile companies to waste their time making high-end cotton fibre. It's the sort of product that it's much easier simply to buy from those countries that produce it, which is mostly China. And yes, Western governments can say that it's needed because they need to produce more artillery shells to help Ukraine. But Western companies who find themselves facing those sort of demands are inevitably simply going to come back and are going to say, well, that's fine. We'll produce all this cotton fibre, high-end cotton fibre for you, and you all the TNT that you want while the war is over, while the war is underway. But what happens after? What happens when the war ends? When the big contracts finish? Will you then continue to buy from us TNT? Will you pay the enormously high profit margins that we are going to insist on? So, of course, the interest in doing it from industry in the West is no longer there. The Chinese and the Russians have a completely different approach to industry, to manufacturing. I've discussed this in many programs. Others have done so too. Brian Beletic has touched on this many times. You would need a revolution in the way in which industry is practiced in the West to address these problems. And you can throw money at this, but unless you establish proper planning agencies in the West and carry out that industrial revolution, these problems are going to continue. Anyway, let me finish by returning to the topic of Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel, who in my opinion has played a massive role in engendering this entire crisis. Anyway, she, I suspect, as she is, whatever else she is, a clever person, knows that the war is going to be lost. She also sees what Friedrich Merz is up to in Germany. She's very well aware of the deindustrialization that is gathering force there, and she knows how the sanctions policies have brought it about. So she is now busy deflecting blame from herself for that disaster. She's recently given an interview to a Hungarian media outlet saying that she could have avoided the entire crisis with Russia. She had this plan in the summer of 2021 to develop some kind of major negotiating platform for the European Union with the Russians. But those terrible people, the Poles and the Balts, put it to a stop. And if this platform had been created and negotiations had been conducted, well, it's quite possible that the special military operation and all that has followed since would not have begun and would never have happened. Nobody, in my opinion, should be fooled by this. Firstly, I remember that incident, that episode, very well. And yes, the Baltic states did object, and the Poles also objected. But the basic reason why the plan, the 2021 plan, never happened is because others, other hardliners, who Merkel does not want to mention, also objected too. And the person who was most vocal, as I remember, was the then Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, who made it absolutely clear that he wanted to have no dealings with the Russians at all, and who said to Merkel, if you want to talk to the Russians, to Putin, fair enough, you can, but don't expect me to join. So that contribution from Rutte, a disastrous one, by the way, in my opinion, killed the whole project stone dead right from the first moment. But the thing is, that platform was being created by Merkel in the last weeks before she stepped down as Chancellor of Germany. I can't help but think that it was mostly intended to give her an alibi, because after all, if she had wanted to move the dial, if she'd really wanted to come to a general resolution of the conflict in Ukraine and to establish a stable long-term relationship with the Russians, she had plenty of time to do it. Now, the Russians have responded to this interview by Merkel. So, of course, have the Poles and the Balts. They are furious with Merkel because they feel that she is blaming them. And, you know, I can understand why. But the Russians are angry also. And a senior Russian official, Vladimir Jabarov, who is first deputy chairman of the Russian Federation Council's International Affairs Committee, has given an interview in which he said that Merkel has done a great deal of harm. If you recall, Merkel, when pursuing her policy, made sure to lull us with the Minsk agreements and the Paris meetings. We believed her because we thought the Europeans truly wanted to peacefully settle the Donbass issue. As it turned out, they were just buying time to provide Ukraine with everything necessary to fight our country. That is why I don't trust Merkel. She did a great deal of harm in this regard, and as a result, our relations with the Germans and Europe as a whole deteriorated sharply. And I have to say, I agree with Japarov here. Merkel is busy constructing alibis for when the defeat and the disaster comes. But none of us should be fooled by what she's saying. Anyway, this is where I'm finishing my programme today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.